The title of the message for today is one that I really, really like, actually. Title of the message for today is, I am not, I am not. I am not what, right? What does it sound like? I am not. It sounds like someone is denying something, right? Someone is denying something. And, you know, we get accused. You're such a liar, right? Ugh, you're such a hypocrite. You're such a, I don't know, you know, you're such a bad person. And we often say, no, I am not. I am not. Sometimes we go even as far as, I swear to God, I am not. You know? You know, in life, I think there are times we want to deny. And we have to deny. But oftentimes what is real and what is true we deny, don't we? Right? You are such a liar. And you know you're lying and you say, no, I'm not. We tend to do that, right? So what is denial? Would you think with me, what is denying or denial? It's a refusal to admit what is true or the accusation. And sometimes they are both true. Both true. Okay? So keep that in mind. And today we'll be looking at a famous story of Jesus, not Jesus, Peter, denying Jesus three times. And we know this story from our Sunday school. And it's not a, you know, unknown story. When Peter denied Jesus at a very critical moment. And I want to just remind you, we are now in the 18th chapter of John's Gospel, which is the climax. We are heading toward the climactic moment. And the tension is being built. And I pray that you will begin to feel that, because finally we're done with the teaching. We're done with the prayer in chapter 17. Now the history unfolds, right? Jesus is heading toward the court and eventually to Calvary. That's what's happening. And this story is very, very interesting because just a few hours ago, Peter was so adamant about his position. He said, sort of like this, I don't know about this, all these guys, 10 other disciples, they may disown you, Jesus, but not me, not me. You could count on me. You have my word. It's that kind of confidence. It's that kind of like, kind of heart. I don't think Peter was insincere, do you? I think he was sincere. I think he meant it. He really desired to be Jesus' follower and defendant. I think that's what he desired. But do you remember Jesus' response? As soon as he finished saying that, Jesus goes, no, 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 no. Peter, you don't understand. In a few hours, you're going to disown me. You're going to deny me three times before the rooster crows twice. Okay? But now, today's text is so interesting. It took me a while to really put together. Because there are really two stories that are kind of like intertwined together. So like meshed up together. It's like, it's amazing. One is Jesus' trial and the other is Peter's denial. They even rhyme. Trial and denial. Okay? And it's like trial, denial. Literally. In today's text. And my question is that an accident? Or is that an intentional thing that the author is trying to say something to us? Well, we're going to think about that. That's what I thought about this week. Trial, denial. And I want to give you a little bit of background because both Jesus' trial and Peter's denial stories, these two stories are in all four Gospels. That's a very important information because there are four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And first three, we call that synoptic because they are kind of similar. And John is like altogether kind of like different. Johannine Gospel. But there are some stories, not all of them, about Jesus' account that are in all four Gospels, such as baptism of Jesus, such as feeding of 5,000, such as Jesus' trial and Peter's denial and things like that. Not whole a lot. A lot of miracles are not recorded in all four Gospels. A lot of even the sayings are even recorded in all four Gospels. But these two stories, they do. Okay? Denial of Peter and trial of Jesus. So they must be important. And at the same time, they go kind of like together. It's like intertwined together like a double helix DNA. Those of you who know what I'm talking about, it's like DTDT, denial, trial kind of thing. Okay? So I want to talk about Peter's denial first, which is a story that we all know well. Can I have the clicker, please? Thank you. Okay. And it starts with the trial portion. And the denial portion starts with the red. I just kind of highlighted with red. Starting with verse 15, and this is the 18th chapter of John's Gospel. It begins like this. Simon Peter followed Jesus. And I think that's a significant statement. Simon Peter followed Jesus. What about the other 10 disciples? Where are they? We don't know. Presumably, they just kind of disappeared and just kind of abandoned. Okay? So Simon Peter followed Jesus all the way to the courtyard of the high priest. Okay, Simon Peter followed Jesus, and so did other disciple. There's another disciple who was following, probably not one of the 10. Okay. Since that disciple was known to the high priest, he entered with Jesus into the courtyard of the high priest. So before we go any further, who is that the other disciple? It's probably not one of the 10 disciples because it says that he knew the high priest. So unlikely. So then who could that be? It could be someone like Nicodemus or Arimathea, Joseph of Arimathea, who was a rich man, perhaps some relationship with the high priest. Okay? And whatever the case may be, verse 16, but Peter stood outside the door. He couldn't get in, right? So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to the servant girl. It was a servant girl of the household of high priest. That's all she was, who kept watch at the door and brought Peter in. And verse 17 is what happens. Okay? The servant girl at the door said to Peter, "You also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" It was probably like spontaneous question, accusation, and true statement, isn't it? Okay, so "you also are not one of this man's disciples, are you?" And then he said, "I am not. I am not." So that's his first denial, okay? And now the servants and the officers had made a charcoal fire because it was cold, and they were standing and warming themselves. And Peter was also with them, standing and warming himself. I don't know what verse 18 is. We'll talk about this. So what we see is after Peter's adamant confession about how much he is determined to follow Jesus, when actually it happened, he did follow. He's the only one that I see, that we see in the Gospels, who followed all the way to Sanhedrin, all the way to the high priest. But it was a servant girl, just a servant girl asking this, probably a question, scared Peter, caught off guard, perhaps. And the denial was more like spontaneous, instinctive kind of thing. "You are not, you surely are not one of his disciples, are you?" It's a negative way of asking the question, "Are you one of his disciples?" And grammatically speaking, expecting a negative answer. No, I'm not. In other words, I can't believe you are here. And to that, Peter said, I am not, an adamant denial. Kind of interesting. But verse 18 is kind of interesting because it seems like an unnecessary information that's there, doesn't it? What is that about? Now, the servants and officers had made a charcoal fire. Okay, charcoal fire. Because it was cold. It was at night. Okay, and they were standing and warming themselves. And it says Peter was with them, standing and warming himself. I'm not sure exactly what it is. But if you go to next denial story, which is starting in verse 25, after trial story, which we will look at. Verse 25, it begins with the same description, which is kind of intriguing. Now, Simon Peter was standing and warming himself. Now, that doesn't sound like an unnecessary information, but sound more like intentional information that the author wants readers to have. Peter was standing there, warming himself with these people who wanted to hurt Jesus. You know, it's kind of interesting because in verse 5, in this story, in the process of Jesus is being arrested by Judas and the Roman soldiers, in verse 5, it's interesting after Jesus said, I am he, right? And then the author includes Judas, who betrayed him, was standing with them. I think I began to see that's what he wants to emphasize. I think who you stand with is very, very important. Where you stand. Make your position known. Are you one of us? Are you one of them? Make your position known. And also I'm reminded of that verse from Psalm 1, verse 1. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked and stand in the way of sinner and sit in a seat of mockers. Do you see the progression? Who does not walk, actively walk, right? And then who does not stand in the way of sinner, and he is standing with them, right? And that's kind of what we see. So he was standing with his enemies and warming himself, kind of disguising himself as one of them, I suppose. So they said to him, and here comes the second accusation, okay? You also are not one of his disciples. Are you? Same accusation. But true statement, right? And he denied it and said, I'm not. And one of the servants of the high priest, a relative of the man whose ear Peter has cut off, Malchus, remember his name, and asked, did I not see you in the garden with him? I saw you. Did I not see you in the garden with him? Another accusation. True statement. And Peter again denied it. And once the rooster crowed. So that's the denial story. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Now, as I told you, this story is written in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. And this story is kind of like bland. But if you read Matthew's story and Mark's story, it's a little bit more exciting. Let me explain to you. If you have an opportunity, go home and read it. It's a little bit more exciting. And I've chose to use Mark version, Mark chapter 14. Same thing. He denied it once and twice and third time. And this is the action kind of like heightens. Verse 70, Mark chapter 14, verse 70, it was people who are standing with Peter asking this question. Certainly, you are one of them, for you are a Galilean. Accusation. True statement. And Peter responded with much more action. Would you listen to this? Verse 71. But Peter began to invoke a curse upon himself and to swear, I do not know this man whom you are talking about. Now, that's different intensity, isn't it? Let me read that one more time. He began to invoke a curse upon himself and to swear, I do not know this man whom you speak. And that's altogether a different kind of intensity. What is he doing? You know, we do that in our culture, don't we? Like, you're such a liar. You're lying, aren't you? He goes, I swear to God. We do that. I swear to God. Presumably, we fear God. And if not, if I'm lying, I should be cursed. But we don't fear God. We just say it. But in Jewish culture, what Peter was doing was, this is a culture, culture where Jews really revere and fear the Lord. They dare to say anything in the name of the Almighty. But that's exactly what he's doing. Okay? What Peter is doing, saying is this, because in the name of Yahweh, which is the strongest way of making an oath and making a statement that what I am saying is the true statement, in the name of Yahweh, in front of him, which we fear and I fear, I am telling you the truth. If I am speaking a lie, the curse will fall upon me. I'll be cursed. Peter did that. Okay. Was he saying the truth? Is denial true? No, he was lying. So obviously that oath and the curse is upon him. No? I do not know this man. He doesn't know Jesus, right? You are one of them. You are Galilean. No, I am not. He's not? He doesn't know him? Of course he knows him. So that's the story of Peter's denial. Okay? Now let's look at the trial, Jesus' trial, which is a little bit more, it involves more. And I don't know whether you have kind of like worked it out when you read through the Gospels. When you get to chapter 26, 27, you begin to kind of like glance through it, and you don't really walk through it. And that's my my tendency as well. But I'm going to ask you to do something. This week and next week, we're going to go through the trial, and it is really, really interesting. And I'm going to try to explain so that it will be digestible, okay? So let me begin with the overview. There are two trials, Jewish trial, and then there is a Roman trial. You know that. He's a Jew. He was accused by his own people, the Jews, and then taken to Pilate, to the Roman trial, and then that's where he was sentenced to be crucified so that his prophecies may be fulfilled. That's where we are heading toward to. Now let's think about this Jewish trial, which has three parts. Okay, stay with me. First part is what we just read in John chapter 18. A preliminary hearing with Annas. And he was the high priest, and Caiaphas was the high priest. So it's a little confusing. Who is the high priest? It is Caiaphas who is the Rome-appointed official high priest. But it is the Annas who is the father-in-law. He is the father-in-law, and he is the patriarch of this high priest family of Annas. His five sons were high priests, and his son-in-law was a high priest. In other words, it was a monopoly domineering. He was the patriarch of this high priest family, which means all the Jews saw him as their high priest. So, after Jesus was arrested by the Roman soldiers and Jewish soldiers, they first take him to Annas. And what we read here today is the preliminary hearing. And we mentioned this last week. One of the things that John emphasized in John's gospel is that Jesus is leading the way. Even through his suffering, trials, and death, Jesus is in control. He's divine. And so he stands before Annas, and basically Annas cannot handle Jesus. Of course not. Now think with me. Jesus is the righteous one. The righteous one. Sinless. And he has to be found guilty so that he may be able to die. Now, do you see where this is going? He is completely righteous one, fully righteous one, the righteous one. sinless, but somehow he need to be sentenced to guilty, right? So that he will be sentenced to death. So something really radical needs to happen in between. Okay, so what Annas did was, as we see it in verse 24, he sent Jesus to Caiaphas, where the second phase of Jewish trial begins. And the capital case, which is what this is, because Jesus needs to be put to death, it has to take place in Sanhedrin during the daytime. But the second phase takes place in the middle of the night, emergency, totally illegal, completely illegal. Okay, but John's gospel does not handle that, but it is in Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And if you read all of them together, especially if you are kind of like interested in the law and things like that, it's so good. Okay, I had a consultation this week from someone from this congregation, right? And I chose to use Matthew version. Okay, here's the Matthew version. Okay. Jesus was sent from Annas to Caiaphas for the second phase of illegal hearing before the Sanhedrin in the middle of the night. And here is how it is written by Matthew. Then those who had seized Jesus led him to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders had gathered. And Peter was following him at a distance. Do you see the kind of like intertwined and juxtaposed together like that, right? And Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest. It's happening together. Peter's denial and Jesus' trial. It's happening together simultaneously. And going inside, he sat with the guards to see the end. And I think that's a very interesting description as well. Now he's sitting down. He was walking, he was standing, now he's sitting down with his enemies. Okay, so interesting. Verse 59. Now the chief priest and the whole council were seeking false testimony against Jesus that they might put him to death. But to us, to casual readers, that doesn't sound like anything. But in light of court case, that is ridiculous. Now, what's the whole purpose of trial? Justice, fairness, isn't it? So the judge and the jury need to be fair. But look at this. The judge, the chief priest, and the whole council, the jury, the elders, they were seeking false testimony. They're not even looking for true testimony because there is no true testimony. That's enough to kill him. They're looking for false testimony against Jesus, which is completely unfair because jury and the judge needs to be fair. But they come in with already this mind as a mob. They wanted to put him to death. Do you see what's happening? Chief priest and the whole council were seeking false testimony against the defendant that they might put him to death. In other words, they already had the verdict in mind. Completely unjust. Verse 60, but they found none. That's a troublesome thing, isn't it? They have to kill him, and Jesus has to die, but they cannot come up with a witness and reason to sentence him to death. That's a troublesome thing. They found none, so though many false witnesses came forward, and at least two came forward, something happened, right? At least two came forward and said, this man said, I am able to destroy the temple of God and rebuild it in 3 days. Now, do you recall this is what Jesus said in the first Passover in John chapter 2? Destroy this temple and I'm going to rebuild it in 3 days. This is a significant thing. And this is a true statement. Okay? But the witnesses have to come up with a testimony that matches. That's really complete. See what happens. So I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. Verse 62. So the judge, high priest, stood up and said, have you no answer to make? What is that these men testified against you. Okay, now you speak. Now he has an option as a defendant, whether to speak or not speak. Okay, you know the fifth amendment, right? Anything that will go against you, you don't have to say, right? And that applies here. And guess what Jesus decided to do? He doesn't speak. Where am I? Okay, verse 63, but Jesus remained silent. Why is he doing that? Is he cupping out? Is he just being fearful now? Why is he doing that? My interpretation, that accusation is not enough to sentence him to death. So he chooses to be silent. Now, if that's what's happening, there were no witnesses and there were no testimony that's enough to that could come together to make him guilty, nor any case that could sentence him to death. Now, this whole case, according to the Synoptic Gospels, is heading toward acquittal, not guilty. But that's not good. That's not what they want. And that's not what Jesus wants. Isn't that kind of interesting? Jesus doesn't want not guilty here. He has to go to the cross. He has to die. In fact, that's why he came. So what happens then? What happens next? I really think it's the intervention of God. Jesus kind of takes over. Now, watch this, okay? Watch this. This is brilliant. So Jesus remains silent. And then Caiaphas, the sly one, and brings up with a brilliant stroke. And this is what he does, and what he does is completely illegal. Again, high priest said to the defendant, I adjure you, in other words, I charge you, under the oath, in the name of the Almighty God. Okay, remember we talked about that? I adjure you, by the living God, tell us if you are the Christ and you are the Son of God. Wow, that's completely illegal. And the judge is not supposed to corner the defendant like that. But he does that. But right before the case, he remained silent, and he kept, you know, his right. Now, at this point, Jesus could have just kept silent, keep his Fifth Amendment right, and found being not guilty, right? Completely. That's the situation. Is that a true statement, though? Tell us, under the name of oath, in the name of Almighty God, Yahweh, whom they revered, would you say you are the Messiah? Are you the Christ? Are you the Son of God? Which is a brilliant stroke. And guess what Jesus decided to do? Jesus decided to answer. And he decided to answer in a way that he makes sure he will be sentenced to death. Let's look at it, okay? Verse 64, Jesus said to him, you have said so. In other words, says, I am. I am the Christ. I am the Son of God. But if you tell me from now on, you will see the Son of Man, referring to himself, seated at the right hand of the mighty God, mighty one, okay? Referring to God himself, and coming on the clouds of heaven, kind of like alluding to Daniel, that I am Yahweh. I am God. What is Jesus doing here? You know what he's doing? He could have kept himself just silent and not say anything and get out of this whole situation. And he could have done that, but he didn't. You know what he decided to do? He decided to self-incriminate himself, put the curse upon himself. The curse of the law was placed upon himself because, to their eyes, he's claiming that he is God. Which is an amazing thing happening here. You know, this whole thing was going toward the acquittal. But Jesus kind of like steps in and he begins to lead. So that this whole case will go to guilty and guilty to death. So what happens? Basically, when he said, "I am Messiah, I am the Messiah, and when I am the Son of God," basically they began to tore their clothing and say, "This is blasphemy. He's claiming to be God. There is no other reason to to leave him alone." So verse 65, when the high priest tore his robes and said, "He has uttered a blasphemy. What further witnesses do we need? We have now heard his blasphemy. What is your judgment?" And they answered, "He deserved death." Unanimous decision, which is completely legal. Okay? So that's what's happening here. Can I just explain a little bit about Jewish law, Hebraic law, which I don't know much about, but you will find this so helpful. Okay? Hebrew law, Jewish law, originated from God's law, Mosaic law. Who gave that law? Our God. So if you look at Hebrew law, okay, it displaces the character of God, merciful, and who is just. And that's the law. Okay? So that's what we're supposed to see, and because it displaces the character of God, mercy and justice, and Hebrew law, they'll do everything possible so that the person will not be sentenced to death. So in the capital cases, they do all this careful way of trying to save the defendant, not to put him to death. Let me explain. The court in capital cases, they could only meet authorized to sit in Israel was the Great Sanhedrin, the highest court, during the daytime with 71 members present. So what is happening here is just completely sham. Completely sham, right? The tradition followed from 70 elders and Moses from a book of Numbers. What about the qualification of the judge and the jury? The high priest and the elders. You know, among other important things for capital cases, he or they must not have any personal relationship or personal reason to harm the defendant. In other words, you have to be very, very neutral and just. Do you see what's going on here? Right? And if you have any bad feeling or relationship, you'll be out of that, process, judicial process. What about the witnesses? So interesting. Now, which is central in Jewish court. There are three qualifications. Number one, for capital cases, the testimony of the witness had to be complete. It had to be complete. And rabbinic law does not allow a person to capital unless all witnesses charge him with one and same criminal act. In other words, if there's any discrepancy in terms of witnessing, the case is dismissed. Do you see what the law is doing? Second qualification is that there must be two or more witnesses to convict. Okay? And the third one is the most important one. In the Jewish court, there is no prosecutor. The one who is witnessing has to prosecute, placing his own life, that I am speaking the truth, on the line, and you have to witness and you have to prosecute. Do you follow? Characteristic of the Jewish law. Okay. So you need to make arrangement to arrest, and you need to place accusation before the nation's judges. To sum it up, this is what I'm trying to say. Jewish law, death penalty could not have been secured against anyone in Israel except under the most extreme and unusual circumstances. It is written that only one out of 7 years, every 7 years, someone would be sentenced to death. And they did a miracle here. The righteous one, the fairest of 10,000, has been sentenced to not only guilty, but guilty by death. Pretty amazing. One more thing, the mode of trial for capital cases. It had to be done during the daytime, between the two sacrifices in the morning and sacrifices in the evening. The reason is that that's what they believe, that we need to do it before the eyes of the Lord during the daytime. And it was happening at night, right? And judges were never to seek to condemn the accused, but rather showing mercy and finding everything possible that could lead to acquittal. That's what the judge is supposed to do, high priest supposed to do. That's what the jury is supposed to do. Okay? And this is an interesting one. If there isn't a unanimous vote, he need to be put to death. Unanimous vote and decision will be automatically disregarded to avoid a mob reaction. Do you understand that? So it was very, very careful. A couple more. If there is an initial guilty vote, he has a chance to be guilty and sentenced to death. And if that person's guilty, they never pronounce the death sentence on the same day. The judge and the jury would go home and they would spend the night, think through this over. Does he or she really deserve to die? And they would always take time, and next day they would convene and take a new vote and then decide, which is completely not happen here. One last one. They were so careful to the point that even as the death, march left, in other words, someone was, you know, sentenced to death and he's on his way to execution. And if there is any reason that the juries find any other reason that they should reconsider, they will bring him back and discuss fully before decide to sentence him to death. That's Hebrew law. That's Jewish law. The point of is this. Jesus was not condemned under a primitive, barbaric, even inadequate judicial system, but it was one of the best in history under the Mosaic law. Supposed to show him mercy and just. And the righteous one was sentenced to guilty and guilty by death. That's what happened. Why did Jesus do that? Why did Jesus self-incriminate himself? He could have said, he could have just kept silent, right? And I think about this case with Peter, because I don't think it is coincident that they are intertwined together. They were both accused, and they both swear to God. And one denied, and Jesus did not deny. Do you follow? One of the distinctive feature of John's gospel, among other very, very interesting thing, such as John's gospel emphasized the deity of Christ. You know that, from the beginning. In the beginning was the Word. Word was with God, and the Word was God. And you know, that's, from the beginning, it emphasized the deity of Christ. It emphasized the Holy Spirit. It emphasized the Passovers. And you know all of these. And there is one thing that I would like to introduce. John's gospel emphasized individuals. Nicodemus in chapter 3. Women at the well in chapter 4. A woman caught at the act of adultery in chapter 8. A man born blind since birth, chapter 9. Lazarus, chapter 11. Thomas, chapter, 19. And Peter, chapter 18. Individuals. And Peter denied, and Jesus pursued a trial. Why did Jesus do that? It is his great love for his people, isn't it? He cannot disown God. Swear to me, are you the Messiah or the Son of God? And Jesus said, I swear, I am. He did not disown his own Father, nor us. If he said no and or kept silent, then there is no Christianity and there is no church and there is no you and I. But he did not disown. In fact, the truth of the matter is, he cannot disown. He could never lie. Was that a true statement? Yes, it was a true statement. If that is the case, the story of Peter is highlighted in the scripture, is recorded in all four gospels. I think that represents you and I, the followers of Christ. Peter was following Jesus. But he was weak. He was feeble. He was maybe perhaps overconfident, right? So he cursed and he made an oath that I do not know him. So curse should be upon him. But Jesus self-incriminate and place curse upon himself for Peter. And he went to the cross. He had to. That's why he came. And that's the love of Jesus. Is that the end of Peter's story? You know it is not, right? You know it is not the end of the Peter story. Fast forward to chapter 21. And I find it is most fascinating. That's the final episode of John's gospel. It is about Jesus revisiting, reinstating this particular person, Simon Peter, who disowned him just a few days ago in a very, very incredible manner. Do you remember that? It was Galilee, Sea of Galilee. Are you a Galilean? No, I'm not. Now he's back to Galilee, right? And there was a charcoal. You're going to see a charcoal there as we saw charcoal. And Jesus prepared a breakfast. Remember that? Simon Peter was fishing, and they caught nothing, him and his disciples. And Jesus, prepared breakfast, called them over. Hey, come over. Throw your net to the right, and you'll catch many fish. And they did, and prepared the breakfast, and feed them, and pulled Simon Peter aside. And ask this question, listen, Simon Peter, do you agapao me? Is Jesus asking because he's not sure? Absolutely not. You know that's not why. And Peter said, yes, Lord, I love you. And then he asked again, second time, hey, Peter, Simon Peter, do you agapao me? Do you love me? Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. And then Jesus will ask third time, okay, do you phileo me? Do you love me? And then at that point, Peter was kind of sad because he kept on asking the question and basically said, you know all thing. And you better believe he does. Right? Can I just ask you, why did Jesus come back in John chapter 21 and kind of close the whole story like that? Is it to pay back? How could you possibly do that, Peter? I need you to the most. And that's when you denied me. Is that why he's there? To just kind of like pin him down and accuse him? No, no. Is he trying to remind his failure so that his wound will get rubbed with pain and salt, and is that why? No, no. Is he saying, see, because of you I was cursed, and try to like get back to him? Is that what he's trying to do? No, it's not. In fact, his curse, he self-incriminate to himself. That's why he went to the cross. For Peter, followers of Jesus. Then why is he there? I think by asking this question, do you agapao me? He's let him know how much Jesus agapao him as a good shepherd. Feed my lamb. Take care of my sheep. Feed my lamb. Is that the end of Peter's story? You know that's not the end. What happened to Peter? According to tradition, he went to Rome, and he was on the way to just running away from persecution of Nero, the emperor of that time. He was on his way, just running out of Rome to save his life. Okay, this is many years later. And then on the way of exile, running away from Rome, he sees Jesus again. This is a tradition. Okay. And then Peter was shocked. And, "Lord, where are you going? Quo vadis Domini? Where are you going?" And then Lord said to Peter, "Peter, I'm going back to Rome to take up the cross because you are denying it." And to that statement, Peter turned around and went back to Rome, and he was crucified for the name of Christ. You know, that's the story of the love of Jesus, isn't it? I don't think it's about Peter's story so much. That's the story of Jesus raising up his followers' story, isn't it? Do you realize Peter, who is as weak and feeble as this in 18th chapter, just a few days later, after the Pentecost, after that John chapter 21, when he was baptized with the Holy Spirit, when after the Pentecost, when the Spirit, the Helper, Paracletos, came, do you remember his preaching in Acts chapter 2? And I just want to share one last thing. In chapter 5, he was arrested. Again, he was arrested. And basically, he was threatened. "Will you continue to speak the gospel, or will we're going to kill you. We're going to condemn you." People were threatening him. And this is what Peter said. Peter said, "You listen to me. You consider, should I listen what is pleasing to God or what is pleasing to you?" That's the kind of man Peter becomes. My brothers and sisters, I want to encourage you. I don't know where you feel like you have just kind of failed him. He loves you and he wants to reinstate you, strengthen you. Do you agapao me? Jesus went all the way to Calvary, self-incriminating him, placing curse upon him, so that we may follow him all the days of our lives. Would you place your trust in him today? Would you place your life in him today? Let's pray.